going to go on. Our second speaker is Richard Simon. He's chief of the biometric research branch at the National Cancer Institute. As we mentioned at our first meeting, and we're proud to have you here at this meeting, Dr. Simon. In 1998, he established the Molecular Statistics and Bioinformatics section and has a staff of statistical, mathematical, computational, physical, and biological scientists working on methods for the application of genomic data to cancer therapeutics. Sounds like a good match to our challenge. Welcome.
Thanks very much. I see a lot of friends in the audience, and I have tried to streamline my slide set that is in the materials that was handed out to, in recognition of the time frame. At the end of the talk, I have tried to address the specific questions, the primary question, and some of the secondary questions of the committee. And before getting to that, I would like to give some background material. Talking about use of archived tissue in the development and validation of prognostic and predictive biomarkers, I think it's biomarkers is a term that leads to tremendous confusion, and it's because it's a very ambiguous term. It's a term that actually doesn't mean anything. It just means a biological measurement, and there's different kinds of biomarkers that have different different intensive use, and those different kinds of biomarkers have almost nothing in common, except maybe for analytic validity. And so when we start talking about when we start talking about clinical validity or medical utility, even clinical utility, unless you focus on the intent of use, you're just sort of adding to the confusion. So here we're going to be talking about prognostic biomarkers and predictive biomarkers. I think that's sort of what this committee is about. Now, a lot of the literature, when people talk about biomarkers and clinical validity, really comes from a literature in which people are talking about diagnostic, either early detection biomarkers or tests that tell whether you have the disease or not. And a lot of the concepts that come from those areas actually are not very, very applicable to prognostic and predictive biomarkers. When you start talking about even sensitivity and specificity, you have to think about, well, what do they really mean in the context of predictive biomarkers? Well, it turns out they don't actually mean very much. So you have to make sure we really focus on intent to use. So a prognostic biomarker, some measurement made before treatment to indicate long-term outcome for patients untreated or receiving standard treatment, may reflect both disease aggressiveness and effectiveness of standard treatment. It's used to determine who needs more intensive treatment. That's really generally the intent of use, to determine who needs treatment or who needs treatment beyond what the standard, maybe surgery and radiation therapy or hormonal treatment is. Predictive biomarker is a pre-treatment measurement to identify who will benefit from a particular treatment. Now, the prototypic example of a prognostic biomarker are the gene expression signatures that have been developed for node-negative, ER-positive breast cancer patients who are receiving hormonal treatment. Oncotype DX and MammaPrint are sort of two examples of effective development of prognostic biomarker signatures in those areas. And they're both sort of characterized by the fact that there's a very clear, these are not things that tell you about the nature of breast cancer. These are things that tell you about, for patients with node-negative, ER-positive breast cancer who are going to receive hormonal therapy, which ones of them have such a good prognosis with just those treatments that they might opt to not receive chemotherapy. Not that they are going to have 100% prognosis, but which of them as a group then have such a good prognosis that they might opt not to receive chemotherapy. Now, if you can do that successfully, then you can benefit patients. You don't elucidate the molecular basis of breast cancer. That's a career-long objective, but you develop something that's a benefit to patients. the literature of prognostic factors in oncology, even before we started talking about genomics and multi-gene signatures, is a mess. And there's a huge gap between this very large literature and the fact that most of these prognostic factors are not used. There's a variety of reasons why they're not used, but I think probably the most important one is because they're not therapeutically relevant. They have no intended use, and they weren't developed to have an intended use. They weren't developed in developmental studies in which the samples were selected for an intended use. They weren't developed in studies for patients who had node-negative, ER-positive breast cancer who were receiving hormonal treatment. They were developed in heterogeneous populations of patients that for purposes of studying prognostic factors and in the hopes that maybe then there would be some potential use out of it, which there rarely is. There's also rarely a validation study, and there's rarely any attempt at establishing analytic validity. Recently, Jyothi Subramanian and I reviewed gene expression prognostic signatures in lung cancer, early stage lung cancer. Are they ready for, not only are they ready for clinical use, but even are they ready for clinical trials? And what we found was that of all of these gene expression signatures that had been developed and published mostly in very prominent journals, in our view, none of them were even ready for clinical trials because all of the problems that are seen in the traditional prognostic factor literature also were seen in this gene expression prognostic biomarker literature, plus some additional ones. And in addition, most of the studies are reported in a misleading manner and indicating that that the journals are not doing a very good job of having these papers reviewed properly, and that the associate editors who are probably handling these papers don't know enough about it to actually select the proper reviewers. And that the statisticians who are reviewing these papers are sort of not focusing adequately on the most important issues. Now, a predictive biomarker, an example, prototypic example, would be KRAS mutation in advanced colorectal cancer as a predictive marker for determining which patients are likely to benefit from anti-EGFR antibodies. The curves at the top show progression-free survival and overall survival for patients who have KRAS mutations. The curves at the bottom show those endpoints for patients who have wild-type KRAS. One curve is for the control group. The other curve is for the group receiving the anti-EGFR antibody, in this case, cetuximab. And this is an example of a predictive biomarker. Sometimes people think of there's confusion between predictive and prognostic. Well, when you have an endpoint like survival or progression-free survival, there's no confusion if you have the proper control group, because predictive biomarker means that there's a treatment effect in, say, the marker-positive group, and there's no treatment effect in the marker-negative group. Now, the key steps in the development of biomarkers, in sort of my view, is first to start off with identifying a specific intended use of the biomarker. Second, perform a developmental study using samples appropriate for that intended use. Third, to develop an analytically validated assay or test. And fourth, to perform a focused validation study that assesses the medical utility of the marker or the score or classifier. I'm going to have to skip over some of these slides in the interest of time. The first, when we talk about developmental studies, it's about predictive accuracy. It's not about false discovery rates. It's not about stability of genes in the model. It's about predictive accuracy. And we talk about validation studies for medical utility. It's not actually about predictive accuracy. It's about actionability and getting better outcome for the patients. But overall, validation means fitness for intended use. And this is particularly true when we talk about clinical validation or medical utility, not so much with regard to analytic validation. These terms have been defined previously, except I would emphasize that clinical validation also has no meaning except as in terms of fitness for intended use. I've alluded to developmental studies and validation studies. Developmental studies are the studies that develop, say, the signature, that screen the genes or screen the candidate variables, that combine them, that train the classifiers, that optimize tuning parameters or set cutoff values. They use cross-validation or split-sample validation to give a preliminary estimate of predictive accuracy, they generally focus on predictive accuracy. The validation studies use a previously defined, completely specified single biomarker classifier or score, and generally should use analytically validated tests and focus on medical utility. Now, for a predictive biomarker, the optimal design for assessing whether the medical utility of a predictive biomarker is to take a set of patients, generally who are going to receive either a new treatment or a control, and randomize them to receive the new treatment or control, measuring the marker up front, but not excluding anybody who would otherwise be eligible for this trial, and seeing how treatment effect depends on marker level. It is not generally what has been called the marker strategy design, where you randomize patients to either having the test measured or not having the test measured. In some cases, this kind of design is necessary. In most cases, the marker strategy design is not recommended, at least I would not recommend it. It's generally very inefficient because many patients receive the same treatment regardless of which way they're randomized. It's often poorly informative, and it generally provides no information that is not provided by the what I call the stratification design that I showed on the previous slide. So the optimal design for a validation study generally does not involve randomization between testing and non-testing. It involves either observing patients on low-intensity treatment and measuring how outcomes correlate with biomarker values, or randomizing patients between treatments and observing how treatment effects correlate with biomarker values. In some cases, a trial with optimal structure for evaluating a new biomarker will have been previously performed and will have pretreatment tumor specimens archived. Under certain conditions, a focused analysis based on specimens from the previously conducted clinical trial can provide highly reliable evidence for medical utility of a prognostic or predictive biomarker. In some cases, it may be the only way of obtaining high-level evidence. Published a paper with Soon Paik and Dan Hayes in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute in 2009, which we discussed this, developed what we call the prospective retrospective design. And the guidelines for the prospective retrospective design are as follows. Adequate archive tissue from an appropriately designed phase 3 clinical trial must be available on a sufficiently large number of patients that the appropriate biomarker analyses have adequate statistical power and the patients included in the evaluation are representative. The test should be analytically and pre-analytically validated for use with archive tissue. Testing should be performed blinded to the clinical data. The analysis plan for the biomarker evaluation should be completely specified in writing prior to the performance of the biomarker assays on archived tissue and should be focused on evaluation of a single completely defined classifier. And finally, the results should be validated using specimens from a similar but separate study involving archived tissue. And our conclusions in that paper were that claims of medical utility for prognostic and predictive biomarkers based on archived tissues can either have a high or low level of evidence, depending on several key factors. And these factors included analytical validation of the test, the nature of the study from which the specimens were archived, the number and condition of the specimens, and the development prior to assaying tissue of a focused written plan for analysis of a completely specified biomarker classifier. Studies using archived tissue from prospective clinical trials were conducted under ideal conditions and independently confirmed can provide the highest level of evidence. Traditional analyses of prognostic or predictive factors using non-analytically validated tests on a convenient sample of tissues and conducted in an exploratory and unfocused manner provide a very low level of evidence for clinical utility. And we propose a revision of the ASCO level of evidence scale. Now, the remaining 6 minutes to try to address some of the questions of the committee, my primary recommendations would be developmental studies should be focused on an intended use. Clinical samples should be selected appropriate for that use and the analysis focused on that use. This is generally not what's done. A separate focused validation study of the medical utility of a predefined classifier or score should be conducted. For predictive markers, the study should be based on a randomized clinical trial. For prognostic markers, a randomized trial is not always needed. Prospective retrospective designs, such as I've described, can provide level one evidence under appropriate conditions. And I've tried to address secondary questions. Secondary question number 16 was, when is a test ready for a clinical trial involving treatment choice? That is, involving treatment choice where you would either randomize, so one way might be to randomize to do the test and then have the test determine treatment choice. For predictive biomarkers, that marker strategy design is rarely necessary. It is in some cases, but it is rarely necessary. The stratification design in which everyone is tested and you just randomize between, say, drug A and drug B or regimen A and regimen B, in which the test is not used for assigning treatment, is more informative, more efficient, and does not require using the test to determine treatment, and it provides all of the information obtainable by the marker strategy design in a more efficient way. For prognostic markers, using a test to withhold therapy for patients predicted to be at low risk of recurrence should generally only be done after a carefully performed prospective retrospective analysis for that intended use. Why do signatures not progress successfully through clinical trials? I would say many signatures have clinical validity but no medical utility. Many are predictive of outcome but have no important intended use. I would say most signatures are not developed for any particular intended use. The most common intended use of a prognostic marker is withholding chemotherapy. Few developmental studies identify a subset with such good prognosis that a clinical trial is warranted. Such trials are difficult to conduct and expensive. Most of these prognostic signature studies, if you look at the analysis of them, they look sort of like an exercise in statistical methodology. What's significant after adjusting for what else? Which has the better ROC curve? But they don't address, does this signature identify a group of patients at low enough risk that you might want to withhold, they might opt to withhold chemotherapy, and what are the confidence intervals around that? And are those patients who, stage one patients, or are they a mishmash of other patients? Key steps for development of prognostic markers, I would say, first, a developmental study with archived samples and analysis focus on intended use, often patients with stage one disease who did not receive chemotherapy, and then followed by a validation study, which would be either a prospective trial in which treatment is withheld from the patients predicted to be at low risk, or a prospective retrospective design study. And the key steps for predictive markers, a developmental study with archived samples and analysis focused on predicting response or treatment benefit. There's lots of predictive markers being developed today for new treatments as companion diagnostics. Most every new cancer drug being developed today is being developed with a companion diagnostic. At least the attempt is being made to develop it with a companion diagnostic. The developmental studies are usually phase two trials in which you look at either response rate if it's not randomized or time to progression if it's a metastatic disease study if it is randomized, or if there was a prior, quote, failed phase three trial, then one can use that as a developmental study. Most of these companion diagnostics are actually not signatures. They are single gene, single protein measurements based on the mechanism of action of the drug, and the developmental studies, phase two or failed phase three trials, to see whether those presumed mechanism of actions actually translate into good candidate predictive biomarkers, followed by a prospective randomized phase three trial comparing the new treatments and the control, measuring the marker at the time of randomization but not used for treatment assignment, or potentially a prospective randomized analysis of previous RCTs, as is in the case of the KRAS for colorectal cancer. The anti-EGFR antibodies had already been approved, and it would have been very difficult to go back and do that completely prospectively, but from those previously conducted randomized clinical trials, there was a very high percentage of patients who they had archived tissue on. The issue of what omics data differs among labs. Well, of course it does, but that's what analytical validation is all about, to sort of trace down those differences to introduce the standardizations necessary to get rid of them. And so proper analytic validation requires extensive standardization and industrial style quality control. It's time consuming and it's expensive, and it's rarely done in academia. Proper analytical validation, I think, is often best done by diagnostics companies. Validation studies should be conducted using analytically validated tests. Finally, the question number 10 had to do with an independent test set, and I would just try to point out that split sample and cross-validation are internal validations. If properly performed, either of them are suitable for developmental studies. Neither constitute external validation. Demonstrating predictive accuracy on an independent test set does not itself necessarily demonstrate medical utility. It's not the ultimate goal. Actionability of the test result for altering treatment decisions that benefit the patients in sort of with the designs I've talked about here is sort of what you have to do to demonstrate medical utility. Thank you.
Thank you. Comments? Ned?
So Richard, I saw one of the slides talking about the prospective retrospective studies as sufficient to justify a clinical trial. So getting back to Steve's question.
Not to justify a clinical trial. We recommended that two properly done prospective retrospective studies in our proposed change of a level of evidence scale would constitute level one evidence for medical utility as an alternative to a fully prospective clinical trial.
But one wouldn't.
Right. We okay. recommended two.
So, again, I think one of the things that would be useful at some point is an assessment of the potential biases that might be inherent in a prospective retrospective study. Where are the sources that we haven't accounted for in trying to develop an unbiased estimate of effect? And it's probably a question more for the quasi-experimenters than the clinical trials folks.
Well, what we recommended for example, for a prospective retrospective clinical study of a predictive biomarker, the appropriate clinical trial that you would have to use with archived specimen would be a randomized clinical trial that randomized between the treatments that were relevant to that biomarker. So, and then you would have to have an adequate percentage of the patients in that clinical trial who had specimens. We recommended, I think, at least two-thirds of the patients. And you're right there. You would have to be very carefully document that there was no bias in terms of who you had specimens and who you didn't.
May I speak up for just a minute? As a co-author here, we also suggested that to reach level of evidence one, you probably needed at least two of those, as opposed to a prospective trial that's specifically addressing the marker, where if that's properly powered and performed, you might only need one of those, just like a drug. So that you're right. We recognize there are inherent biases in the prospective retrospective approach. So it'd be nice, if not nice, it requisite to have a couple of those to show the same thing.
Tom,
Rich, Tom Fleming. Thanks so much for these thoughts and for a lot of the slides that you didn't present. That also provided some very interesting insights.
You mean thank you for not presenting them?
No. The you raise an important point about your favoring the efficiency of the stratification design over the marker strategy design. And I think there are some other advantages beyond what you've just mentioned. With the stratification design, you could enter into a clinical trial with a genetic signature and assess it earlier in time than you might otherwise be able to, because you're not changing how people's therapy is being administered. You're just looking for whether or not this genetic signature is an effect modifier. So that design has the advantage also then of being able to be assessed in a clinical setting without as much scientific justification that otherwise might be needed. It's also critical, if we go back to your first slide, it's critical because that's the kind of data that allows you to assess whether the genetic signature is an effect modifier. If we go back to your first slide, if we could do that.
Oh.
Somewhat terminology here, but you refer to prognostic factors and predictors. And I think this contrast is so important. I call prognostic factors low-lying fruit, and what you're calling predictors, like surrogate endpoints, they're the rich things that have great clinical utility. What we really want to know more so than who will survive longer than who will not, we want to know who will benefit most from treatment. And I might use a little bit different terminology, because a prognostic factor is a predictor. It's predicting in the control arm who will do better and who will do worse. Whereas an effect modifier is telling us whether or not who will do better, who will do worse, depends on intervention. And that's the critical fruit that we really wish. So I'd rather call predictors, as an epidemiologist, an effect modifier versus prognostic factors. But let me get to the essence of the issue here. Your last line says prognostic factors used to determine who needs more intensive treatment. Well, it's easier to find prognostic factors. Everything, any data that exists in standard of care can tell you whether or not females survive longer than males.
I would take issue a little bit with that, Tom. I want to find, maybe I didn't word it properly here. I think what you want to find with a prognostic marker, you want to be able to identify a subset of the patients who have such good outcome on either untreated, as it might be an early prostate cancer, or with
cancer. Because I agree with you.
Yeah.
So, but the essence is, it's far harder to find and establish an effect modifier than simply to find a prognostic factor. So, a prognostic factor, like you're saying, who has really high risk? A prognostic factor is good.
Who has really low risk?
Or really low risk, either way. It's useful for counseling. It's useful for directing who you might put in a clinical trial as eligibility criteria. But it doesn't tell us who needs more intensive treatment unless the relative risk is enormous, or unless the treatment is so toxic that you know it couldn't have favorable benefit to risk in the low-risk group. So a simple example, colorectal cancer. I've had curative surgery. Do I have residual disease? If I think I don't, you're in the adjuvant setting. If I do, you're in the advanced disease setting. 5-FU-levamisole works terrifically well in the adjuvant setting. It doesn't work in the advanced disease setting. So just because someone is at low risk doesn't mean they're the ones who don't need more intensive therapy. It might be that the low-risk people are the ones who benefit from the intensive therapy. And so that's my only reservation.
But if they're at a low enough risk, then they cannot benefit very much in absolute terms, because you can't cure a patient twice.
So what I'm saying is, it only will tell us, it only gives us that last bullet point. Not if the relative risk is 2.5, if the relative risk is enormous, and if the therapy has such toxicity, cost, and inconvenience that even if it were eradicating the remaining risk in that low-risk group, it wouldn't be beneficial. However, in most settings, our prognostic factors aren't that powerful. And I've just gave an example. A very powerful prognostic factor is, do you have residual disease that's known and detected after curative surgery? And yet the treatment, 5-FU-levamisole, only works in those low-risk people. And it gives a very important benefit because it cuts the residual death rate in half.
Well, when we reviewed the prognostic signatures for lung cancer, what we found was all of the studies found prognostic signatures, but none of them actually found, with maybe one exception, none of them found prognostic signatures that had a low enough risk for that identified a subset of stage one patients that had such low risk that they might not opt to get chemotherapy. So the focus was on what's prognostic, and so I agree with you. Well, I also agree that the relative risk is a poor measure, but I'm agreeing with you in the sense of even though there were these prognostic signatures, almost none of them identified, none of them were powerful enough that when you focus, say, on stage one patients, they identified a subset who had such low risk that they might not opt to not receive chemotherapy. That's really what the objective is.
Let's hear from Laura.
And maybe one comment on the last part of your talk you gave on the levels of evidence needed for prognostic and predictive markers. I think the publications you refer to, one of your own, I think were written also to evaluate markers for clinical commercial use. And maybe the intent of this meeting is also to see what level of evidence needs to be reached before one can use such markers in clinical trials. And so although in the end we were discussing like whether one or two clinical trials needed to be have shown the validity of those markers, maybe for clinical trials there is a different level of evidence, and already earlier you would use such markers in clinical trials.
Well, you see, the point it would be that with the prospective retrospective design, if you have the appropriate studies that were done previously, even before the marker was developed, then you can use, if you have archived tissues for most of those patients in those trials, you can use those studies. So the idea would be now you don't have to say, well, what sort of evidence do I need in order to do a new clinical trial? The idea was those clinical trials have already been done, and if they were appropriately sized and appropriately structured and the archive tissue appropriately preserved and you have a good enough test for it, then our proposal was that you can use those, and that even if you're going to do something prospective, particularly with existing treatments, as you well know, it can be very difficult or impossible to take a standard of care and start randomizing with it.
I fully agree with you that those would be ideal, but maybe not for all clinical trial design and the use of these tests mandatory.
Let's hold those points and return them in the general discussion in a little bit. Thank you. Also, let's make a mark on the possibility that the funding agencies and the big oncology groups might productively have a process to identify critical clinical questions in relationship to alternative therapies for which such tissue resources are available, and then have a competition for the best candidates to actually apply when you have such precious materials well-defined and agreed to be appropriate. It's a possibility. Okay.